Good to go, Brian.
We good to go. Who's kicking off?
I'm kicking off.
Okay. God help us.
It's the 300th podcast. We're joined by a friend of the show.
300th? Fellow... You said 300th.
Oh, goodness gracious me. That's not a great start to the sorry, how did I get that wrong? It's the 300th podcast. I guess it is the 300th if you split them into hundreds. Anyway,
the end of the 300th, yes.
Yeah, we need to move on. We're joined by a friend of the show and fellow Euromigos and star of many of our debates. In fact, David, some of our most popular podcasts have been the debates, which I think you've held, at best, you've held your own, and sometimes you've excelled to new heights. Welcome, David. We're going to talk about the... this was supposed to be actually an emergency podcast, and it was originally released at the end of ASCO GU, but David was at the airport, and the star of that show was the airport announcer at San Francisco Airport, who had a really prominent role. But we decided, as good as they were in our podcast, because we didn't have their permission to take part, we decided to re-record it. So, David, welcome. We're going to start by asking you to talk about melanoma and the adjuvant melanoma data.
Sure, always an honor to be here. So let's talk about melanoma. The melanoma story, I think, is useful and was discussed a bit at GU ASCO, because I think for reasons that are largely historical, in the world of solid tumor immunotherapy, melanoma has always been at least a couple of years ahead of the rest of the solid tumor world. So, you know, we have a little bit more experience, a little bit more follow-up with our trials. Hopefully that can be useful. So as you all know, the first immune checkpoint antibody to actually gain regulatory approval was ipilimumab with CTLA-4, which was approved in the metastatic setting about 13 years ago now. And after its approval, people thought, you know, sort of a logical thought, which is, if we move this agent up earlier in the paradigm, would it, you know, actually prevent recurrence or produce more cures for patients? So several trials were launched. One of the first was from the EORTC, which was 18071, which was a randomized trial of ipi versus placebo, where the ipilimumab was given at what then was the standard dose of 10 milligrams per kilogram, which was a higher dose than is currently used in the clinic. That trial was a positive study, both for relapse-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.76 and for overall survival with a hazard ratio of 0.72 and a difference in survival of about 10% absolute at 5 years. That trial was then followed by an ECOG cooperative group trial, which was 1609, which looked at a number of different doses of CTLA-4, looking at IPI-10, IPI-3, and comparing to what had then been the standard of care in the U.S., which was interferon. At some level, these trials were done sort of in parallel. That trial showed that IPI-10 was, you know, generally more toxic, not surprising, and was then subsequently classified as, you know, too toxic for adjuvant therapy. But there was a relapse-free survival advantage of IPI-3 versus interferon, and an overall survival advantage of, you know, with a hazard ratio of 0.78, and a, you know, a small difference in 5-year survival of about 5% absolute.
For the IPI-3.
For the IPI-3,
yeah,
over interferon. So over a control arm, which was in many ways not easy to give, not easy to take, but was often given in the U.S. At that point. We've come a long way over the last 15 years, moving away from cytokines largely. Following those, we had the sort of the advent of, you know, a more effective checkpoint inhibition with PD-1 and PD-L1, and both major PD-1 antibodies were tested in this space. The CheckMate 238 study looked at patients with 3B, B and C, and M4 resected patients. That trial was Nevo versus Ipi. That trial did show a improvement in relapse-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.71. you know, improvement and 5-year relapse-free survival of about 9%. The OS was trending in the right direction, but not statistically significant, 0.8.
For the Nevo arm, this was favoring Nevo.
Correct, favoring Nevo, 0.87. Also, at the similar time, the KEYNOTE-054 study, which becomes relevant in our discussion in kidney cancer, looked at stage 3 A, B, and C disease, was pembro versus placebo, had a better relapse-free survival hazard of 0.59, but once again, it was being compared to placebo, not to IPI, and which maintained over 5 years. We have yet to see the overall survival curves from that trial, and now we have 5 years of follow-up from both of these studies. That's at least partially because there was crossover built in to that study where you could get pembro as part of the study if you received placebo and then recurred, and about half of patients did. You could also get re-challenged with PD-1 if you got pembro on the study and then recurred after a certain amount of time. And that crossover actually was useful in far as understanding how active PD-1 was in both settings, which I think would be useful to have that kind of information in kidney cancer, because those questions are going to come up a lot. And once pembro is used, you know, pretty widely in the adjuvant setting, is how well does it work on recurrence and does it work again? And the question, the answer in that trial, the KEYNOTE melanoma study, was it actually is quite active for rechallenge with a response rate of close to 40%. I think it was like 39% or something like that, with CRs in the rechallenge setting, you know, I think of close to 14%. It was also active in the patients who had gotten it before, not as active, but there was at least one responder in that setting. And there certainly was toxicity in both groups. But, you know, one of the stories in melanoma is that, and probably the reason we don't see overall survival in that study, is PD-1 is active as salvage therapy, you know, and CTLA-4 is active, and certainly the targeted therapies are more active in melanoma than kidney cancer. There have also been other trials subsequently, the COMBI-AD trial, which is looking at BRAF-MEK, which has certainly crushed placebo and led to the approval of BRAF-MEK inhibition for those patients. About half of the patients with melanoma have a BRAF mutation and can have that as an option in the adjuvant setting.
That's for PFS. And what's their PFS, and do they have OS?
They have both.
DFS, yeah.
So it is relapse-free survival is 0.51 with a 5-year improvement of about 16% absolute. OS is 0.57.
Wow.
You know, in that study. There have been now, I won't go into them in detail, but they're similar, just different stages. They've both been both a KEYNOTE 716 and a CheckMate 76K, which are now in stage 2 B and C, which have led to the use of pembro and nevo in stage 2 melanoma, so earlier stage. But I think one of the important things to think about, and this gets back once again to our renal question, is risk assessment. We have, a better sense of risk of recurrence in melanoma than in kidney cancer because we've had a longer history of adjuvant therapy in that setting, for one, and the data sets are bigger. And patients with stage 2, B, and C disease have similar recurrence chances as patients with 3A and B disease. So when you're talking to patients, you have, you know, a broader discussion about risk and how much you can reduce your risk, both for now stage 2 and stage 3 disease. So needless to say, PD-1 of both stripes, Nevo and Pembro, has been used now for probably 4 or 5 years.
And what is that risk, David, roughly percent-wise for a...
It depends. It can vary in stage 3 disease for you know, in 3A, at like 10 or 15% to, you know, over 50% or more for 3D disease. Similarly for, you know, 2B and 2C, the risk is non-trivial. I think one of the interesting things, which we don't quite understand, is the activity of PD-1 in some trials with 2B disease is actually greater than 2C. We don't quite understand that, but the risk is real.
Those numbers are a little lower than renal, right? Those are Do you think the risk of recurrence in the melanoma trials, broadly speaking, is the same, or is it a little lower than?
It depends on the trial. For example, it depends if they included 3A patients. So 3A patients, as I said, generally have a relatively low risk. So when you're talking to those patients, and this may be an issue that comes up in melanoma too, you're often into a discussion of, in part because we don't know OS, you're in part saying, well, you have, let's say, a 15% chance of recurrence. And if we reduce that risk by 40%, your risk is now, 11% or whatever it is. Do you want to do it? And patients get confused by that math. I find it hard to explain those differences, but those are the real numbers. I mean, you and Katie Beckerman have emphasized this in and kidney cancer, which is, it's one thing to talk about a 40% reduction in risk, but then you have to figure out what the actual risk is. And then that risk reduction, when you do that, becomes relatively small. And I think one of the other big issues for kidney cancer is I'm not sure we really understand risk as well in the modern era of, of modern surgeries and, all the rest, because a lot of those numbers are kind of old.
David, one of the things you said previously is, one of the trials is you didn't have OS. But does the melanoma community think, because the original IPI trial did have OS, that actually, and in the subsequent trials, you've got IPI versus Nevo or IPI versus Pembro as the control arm is an active control arm, that there is OS in this field and these drugs are associated with OS. It's just the OS was from the IPI, not from the subsequent therapy. Is that true?
These are things we debate a lot. I think there's a divide in the field. There are people who feel that we haven't shown OS and therefore we should hold, and salvage is very active, so we should hold off therapy in most patients until they recur. The predominant feeling is that for patients at higher risk than 3A patients, so 3B, C, and D, patients with 2B and C disease, that just the ability to reduce their risk of recurrence has value if that's all you are doing, because patients don't want to recur. Patients are scared to death of recurring, and we all have patients who recur that we can't salvage. About half of the patients with metastatic disease or more die of their disease. So I think you're sort of saying two different things, I think, which is you can't say we know it improves overall survival, but we think it probably does in the aggregate, and it certainly reduces the anxiety of and the fear that's associated with recurrence.
In the original IPI versus placebo trial,
yes,
what proportion of patients got on to get subsequent immune checkpoint inhibition relapsed?
I think it was relatively low because they were not available as approved drugs during that time.
And so therefore, do some people argue that we never really salvaged people in that trial, and therefore that's why we're not sure about the OS signal?
Correct. I think most people feel that the reason there's no OS signal is because of salvage being much more active now than it used to be. And it comes down to a challenging discussion with patients about what they're more concerned about. Are they concerned about the risks of toxicity, or they're concerned about the risks of recurrence? And I think that our patients in melanoma tend to skew younger, and they're much more worried about dying from their disease than they are if they might be 75 or 80 years old. So there are nuances to this discussion, but I would say for patients with high enough risk, we're treating those patients. That said, we don't treat all patients for which it's approved. So 3A patients who might have a 15% risk of recurrence, I'm trying to convince those people most of the time not just to be observed, because I've had some bad outcomes in those patients where patients have died getting adjuvant PD-1 blockade.
So what's
my bias.
What's your minimum risk where you shift the other way, right? So you're not skewing them against, you're skewing them for, or you're...
I think it's about 20% or more.
20, okay. So still pretty low, right?
Yeah. I mean, some people would say it should be 40%, or I think part of it is it's based on sort of personal experience. Like yeah, we sure. all have bad outcomes. I have both bad outcomes with people I decided to observe and then couldn't salvage. I have bad outcomes where I've hurt patients with just one dose of, you know, Pembro or Nevo. And I try to tell patients that the part of the problem though is most patients I see want to know, they want me to tell them what to do, you know? Right. And so some of this sort of ambivalence is, makes for harder discussions. But ultimately to me, it's about two things which are relevant to kidney cancer. It's about getting all the data out there that we have, mm-hmm. And being transparent about the risks and the benefits, you know, so that people can make informed decisions.
Right. I guess. Brian, let's move to kidney cancer. Them.
Okay. Brian, I just want to say that was a gorgeous summary of melanoma, David.
It was beautiful. It really was. Huge pressure. It's put huge pressure on you, Brian, and enormous pressure on me. Because after my terrible introduction, I feel under huge pressure to perform now.
Mine won't be nearly as good. But let me,
Brian, let's hear what's going on in kidney
briefly,
cancer.
There so was. I'll update Keynote 564, which was Pembro versus placebo in resected high risk. We've seen the DFS twice before, and at ASCO GU there was OS. And just a note, the entry criteria was basically T2 grade 4/sarcomatoid or higher risk, which would, again, I mean, a T2 grade 4 is, gosh, probably in the, you know, perhaps 30% risk of recurrence, something like that, depending on other features. So again, a little bit higher, I think, David, than the melanoma world. But be that as it may, the updated DFS hazard ratio 0.72. Again, the median follow-up was almost 5 years in this study. It was 57 months. So almost 5 years, so pretty good. And a absolute difference of just over 8% in relapse, 56.5 versus almost 65. For these patients. And then obviously the big data was the OS, which we had had hazard ratios in the 0.5s before, but immature follow-up, not enough events. And this hit significance with a hazard ratio of 0.62, about 31 more events in the placebo arm. And quite obviously median's not reached, you know, the absolute difference of 5%, 86 versus 91, basically. I think probably the other data that's important is the subsequent therapy of patients with documented recurrence. So about 80% got any subsequent therapy, but that also included a pretty good chunk of patients over 20 or 30% who got radiation and or surgery. And then obviously systemic therapy, and about 2/3 of the placebo patients got immune therapy. Now that denominator was different than the number of patients with recurrence. So it was the number of patients who got therapy. So part of the discussion is around, well, what exactly happened to patients? What about the patients who died? Did they get immune therapy? We didn't get that data. That was part of the discussion and a forthcoming podcast with Hans Hammers coming on that. Do you like how I did that, Tom? Advertising future podcasts.
Okay, so Brian, let's before we come into that, because we've got to, so you want to keep going with that. I want to hear about some of the other studies in this field.
I'm about to tell you, yes.
Okay. Fabulous. I feel like I've wasted the listeners' time.
Thank you. So I think the other biggest data that's the hardest to explain is CheckMate 914, right? And there was a part A and a part B. A was just Nevo versus, it was just Ipi-Nevo versus placebo. Part B, which was just reported at ASCO GU, had three arms, Nevo, Ipi-Nevo, and placebo. And I think the short summary for all that is that the hazard ratios for disease-free survival were basically in the 0.9 range for any of the investigative arms versus placebo, as previously reported and then as just reported. So pretty flatly negative, you know, obviously insignificant p-values, et cetera, nothing in the subgroups, et cetera. So what's hard to explain, I think, for the field is why we have one shiningly positive adjuvant Pembro study and then three others, one with adjuvant Atezo and then a cooperative group nivolumab study that also had a neoadjuvant dose. I think those latter two are easier to explain based on mechanism or study design. But this adjuvant Ipi-Nevo study, you know, the patients who enrolled were broadly similar to the Keynote study. It's obviously both drugs, both Nevo by itself and Ipi-Nevo, are active in the metastatic setting to varying degrees. So I think it presents the hardest data set, if you will, to compare and understand why there's a difference. It was only 6 months of therapy. That's probably the biggest difference.
It's a little hard for me to believe that explains everything, but I don't have a better explanation. But that's basically where we stand. Adjuvant Pembro, the only positive study now positive for survival in a standard of care with some discussion around, you know, as David said, what's your absolute risk reduction? You know, it's about 8% DFS, 5% OS, absolute terms. Obviously, that varies per patient. Estimating risk of recurrence in kidney cancer is exceedingly imprecise. And so you're balancing that against the toxicity that David alluded to.
Brian, let's go through some of the difficult questions. And David, I want to hear your opinion on these two. Number one is that there was some discussion from two of the questions in the session around subsequent therapies and about the trial design and whether all patients should have got subsequent immune therapy. There was discussions about, you know, 48% and the way the data was presented and whether it was presented correctly, because it was only 48% who got subsequent immune therapy. What was your take, first Brian and then David, on this broad subsequent therapy issue, which caused some noise in the room at the time?
I think it's important to get all the data out there, as David said, right? We all want, when we see data, we want more data, right? We want to know exactly what happened, you know? So of the, I think it was 80 some patients who died, you know, in the placebo arm, 86 patients, you know, how many of them died without exposure to active regimens, you know, immune therapy specifically? We don't know that number. Right.
And what percentage would you be comfortable with, you know, of the patients who died? What percentage?
I think, you know, 70 or 80%.
Not everyone.
70-ish percent seems 70. Like a good chunk. It's not going to be 100%, of course.
Yeah, it's never going to be 100%.
You know, but if it's 20 or 30%, you say,
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we would agree that immune therapy is active in the metastatic setting. It should be given early and leads to, you know, prolonged life, right? So,
but not everyone's going to get subsequent immune therapy. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah,
and agreed. The numbers that you saw in front of you, in the knowledge that the good risk patients, you know, that immune therapy is not proven to be associated with survival advantage, and many patients had radiotherapy and surgery. The numbers in front of you at 48%, is that a number which currently you're comfortable with, or is that?
I think it's a bit low, but again, these aren't the final numbers, right? Patients get therapy over
time.
Okay,
so let me push you a bit harder.
And presumably those patients who got local therapy aren't the ones who died, right?
Let me push a bit harder. So then at the meeting, someone said, Han said about the, you know, was there a real world population that didn't have access to subsequent therapy? And he talked about the hazard ratios of 0.68 in the US population versus 0.61 in the rest of the world. Do you think at the moment there's a discrepancy between that US population and the rest of the world?
No, I don't. I mean, I wouldn't. If you look at those, that forest plot, I mean, those, they're pretty much entirely overlapping. So I think we need to be really careful about, we've talked about this before, inferring things from, you know, picking out one part of the forest plot, you know, to your advantage. So I don't know, but at the end of the day, we do know how many patients got subsequent therapy. We do know where they were in the world. We do know if they lived or died, right? So that's just actual data, not sort of inferring by that forest plot.
David, let me come to you. There was discussion about a trial design and the people, the melanoma, some of the melanoma doctors saying that there have been melanoma trials that have been designed differently and they would have been more optimal. Do you think that's the case? And if that is the case, what does that trial look like?
Right. So what Hans was talking about is a trial that I alluded to, which was KEYNOTE-054, which is essentially the Pembro adjuvant study in stage 3 melanoma patients, which was Pembro versus placebo, which had the Pembro crossover built into the study, meaning you could, if you recurred either in nodes or distant metastatic disease, you could get Pembro without having to find it somewhere else, and 52% of patients who recurred got Pembro that way. So not all the patients, but at least half of them. That helps to allay the concern, which we don't know how real it is on the kidney cancer trial, that maybe some of the patients who didn't get PD-1 didn't get it because they couldn't. I mean, it wasn't a choice in the country that they enrolled on, for example, or it wasn't a first-line choice, for example. Now, that information is not easy to get, but it's potentially knowable. It's like, because essentially Chris Ryan's question is a great one. You can get the answer to Chris's question. And then, you know, but you
what was Chris's question?
Chris's question is how many patients who died without seeing PD-1? And then you could adjust your analysis based on that, which is what Gennady Bratislavi wanted us to do, which you could also do. And my guess is if you did both of those things, the overall survival impact would be somewhat less. But so we can get that information. What the next question that I just asked, which is of those people who didn't get it, why didn't they get it? Because there are many different reasons why someone may not get it. Brian alluded to some of those, which is if you're having local therapy, not everyone needs it, for example. Some people may not have gotten it. They needed it, but couldn't get it. So let's try to get that information. Because ultimately, in my opinion, disease-free survival advantage is enough to use the drug in the right patients, right? It's consistent with what we've seen in other tumor types. So I believe that impact is real. But let's try to find out what the true therapeutic index is of PD-1 in kidney cancer. So let's learn more about efficacy. Let's get the answer to these good questions. And let's also talk about long-term toxicity, because that's part of the equation too, and doesn't get talked about in most of these presentations. It's one thing to say toxicity produces a certain amount of grade and a certain amount of incidence, and that's fine. But when, now that you have long-term follow-up, you should also be able to say what's the duration of some of this toxicity and what's the percent of patients where the toxicity didn't resolve. Now, of those patients, many of those patients are living with no symptoms from ongoing tox like hypothyroidism, but some patients might have side effects. Once again, it's not a reason not to do checkpoint for adjuvant therapy, but it just it will help us inform clinicians and patients better. And then it gets to us the place where we all know we need to go, which is better selection criteria. You know, so let's get answers to these.
David, two questions for you. Number one is, you said only 52% of patients in the crossover trial ended Correct. Up getting that pembrolizumab. And here in the adjuvant pembro trial, at an early data cut, we see 58% of patients rather than 52%. Why did it was only 52% of patients getting subsequent pembro?
Right.
The impression we got from the room, I think, was that almost everyone got subsequent pembro.
Okay, right. So we're talking about two different things, and I'm sorry if I'm not being clear.
Sure it's my fault.
No, it's not. 52% got the pembro within the study.
Yes.
That doesn't mean only 52%
okay, fine,
got
that's
PD-1.
Fine.
Right. So, I'm trying to get the number from Dr. Egremont, who's the lead author of the study. Like, do we know in the melanoma trial how many people got the therapy checkpoint, PD-1, CTLA-4, whatever, outside of the study or not? That number is probably higher, but I can't tell you how much higher. But I think one of the issues that draws people's attention is how the data was presented at ASCO, meaning the denominator that's being shown to me is not the most relevant denominator for the discussion. You know, we were left with the impression, for example, by the discussant, Pedro, I believe, that 85% of patients got subsequent therapy. That's not the real number. It's closer to 70% got, you know.
Do you want to explain how that arrived, David?
Well, it's changing the denominator from the number of patients who relapsed versus the number of patients then subsequently who got systemic therapy. So when he went on to say that 70% of patients got PD-1, that's of the patients who got subsequent medical therapy.
And I mean, I think presenting subsequent therapy data is not straightforward. There are lots of different ways of doing it. And I think one of the consensuses of this is many people in the audience felt there are better ways of doing it.
Well, there's additional ways. You can do it that way, but you should also do it
and
the
Brian
other way.
And myself and you have been in many rooms where I've decided the best way of doing this. And I think that the answer to that is that there are different ways of presenting this type of data. And there, one of the challenges I think that we as a group had presenting this is you can spend 10 minutes presenting subsequent therapy data because many patients have more than one subsequent therapy and many patients have multiple lines of therapy. The other bit I think about subsequent therapy that's important is that at the first cut of CheckMate 214, only 27% of patients got subsequent immune therapy. The most recent cut, it's well over 50%. You know, the New England Journal of Medicine, 27%. And then the 8-year data with more follow-up, many more patients get subsequent therapy. So the current proportion of patients getting subsequent therapy will increase increase with time. I've got a couple of patients who are currently on VEGF targeted therapy, for example, who've had adjuvant therapy. They're likely to get second line immune checkpoint inhibition with nivolumab. Now, so I think that this subsequent therapy issue is something that we can dive into in detail. Right. And I think it's a learning from this. And I think there's a huge amount to come from there. But I think that the way it's presented, is it can be very difficult to do that in 30 seconds.
No doubt. And like I said, I don't think when Tony described it, he presented what was on the slide. But when Pedro presented it, he left at least me with the impression that the numbers were better than they actually were. I think he misspoke. But the point of the story is the data is good enough without making it look better than it actually is. And it's important, you know, going forward, that we just err on the side of transparency, because ultimately the experiment that was done here, and this is important for all solid tumors, is early PD-1 better than late PD-1. And I have no doubt, both in melanoma and kidney and probably other tumor types, in some patients, the answer to that question is yes. Mm-hmm. But in this trial, that experiment was not completely carried out. It was early PD-1 versus late for half the group and versus not yet or never for the other half of the patients who recurred. And so we just need to be honest about that. And we just need to try to report as much of the data as possible.
But you couldn't have done a trial where you said all the patients who relapsed with renal cancer could get pembrolizumab. That's not an option for this group of patients.
I think Hans's point is that if you had made the pembro available to all patients at recurrence, the number
off-label
who got it, well, as part of the study, right, you would have gotten more, that percent would be higher. I don't know how much higher it would be, but that his concerns
could have
are
harmed
addressable.
Some patients. Could have
absolutely
harmed some patients.
And it did, and that's the
single
that's
agent
the, pembrolizumab absolutely
perhaps might be harmful.
I agree. And Keynote
054. Could you be doing that? Because many people say you should be giving ipi/nivo. Brahm would say, what about axi/pembro?
Oh, no doubt. And those are important issues. And in the melanoma study, that's why having that information is useful, because it was both helpful and harmful. The tox is real in that setting. And that goes to the other point is this toxicity issue is we're now across multiple cancers. There's not, and they all, these drugs have the same toxicity across all of these diseases. So we have to also focus on the rare bad outcomes, not just the common ones. It's not the common side effects are not the reasons I worry about giving these drugs.
Brian, what's your take on this subsequent therapy issue? And what was your take? The emergency podcast was there because I think there was, you know, it was a good discussion at ASCO GU, and I wanted us to have that discussion here with the three of us. What was your take when you walked out of the room on how much these data, how compelling they were, number one, how accurately you felt they were presented, and how it changed what you thought about renal cancer moving forwards?
I mean, they're clearly compelling data, right? I mean, having a survival advantage, which we haven't seen before, is compelling, especially in light of the other negative renal studies. You know, as you said, presenting subsequent data, and we've been part of these discussions, is really challenging, and collecting that information is hard on a trial, and you know what I mean? So I think the pushback was just around that thirst for more data, as David said. In order to inform a patient of benefit and risk, we need to know everything about the benefit and everything about the risk. And I don't think we know that yet for this study, you know, maybe for any study, but certainly for this study. And so I think it was a natural pushback. I was giving the drug based on DFS alone. So even if OS had never been positive, even if the crossover or the lack of crossover and the subsequent therapy is, you know, clouding the issue a bit, as we've been talking about, okay, it wasn't driving my use. So my use won't probably increase that much. I don't give it to everybody. You know, I give it to people on the higher end of the risk for the reasons I think David alluded to, is, you know, the absolute difference for somebody who only has a 20 or 30% risk of recurrence is pretty small. And it's an older population, et cetera, than melanoma. So it's great data. I think the pushback is normal, and we'd love to get more data because it's important for the field. You know, as David said, transparency, I think, is super important here. And I think it will bump the, you know, I think most people who are using it will use it a little more. You'll talk to patients a little differently. You can now say their survival. You can quantify it, right? 5% at 5 years. So it's helpful, right? And more data is always helpful, but that's how I feel.
We were going to talk about bladder cancer too, but I don't think we've got time, Brian. I think we ought to. I'll talk about it very briefly. I thought Andrea Apollo.
You can't help yourself.
Quite help myself. Andrea Apollo, I'm such a fan of hers. I think she did a brilliant job. Investigator initiated big randomized trial. What can we learn from the other two cancers? And David, I've got to ask you this question. We spend a lot of time in bladder cancer trying to reproduce results from lung cancer. And I don't know why we focused on that. It's partly my fault. We didn't, you know, follow the renal cancer model, obviously. We did a bit, but how much do you, because people come to me all the time and say, you know, the melanoma data shows this and therefore we should be doing this in kidney cancer. And you've today talked a lot about kidney, about melanoma and what we can learn. But it's a completely different disease. You've got more durable responses. Ipi-Nivo works better. You've got another adjuvant therapy, a targeted therapy associated with a survival advantage. Clearly, we didn't have that experience. Should we just completely compartmentalize these? Or do you think that this cross-fertilization and is this cross-fertilization process helpful? Or has it been harmful, actually, as it was in bladder cancer and lung cancer, where we tried to produce the work in lung cancer and we were unable to do it?
Well, I think in general, it's helpful. To me, one of the most exciting things about doing solid tumor immunotherapy has always been what you learn in one disease is potentially applicable in another. And that's not always true. And there you've cited some examples of where it hasn't always been true, but it's more true than with other types of therapy. And we need each other to get answers to some of these questions, both on the efficacy side and on the toxicity side. So, you know, for example, you know, who do we treat? You know, we need better predictors of who we treat. We all need the same things. We need to, you know, push for, you know, minimal residual disease selection markers across these diseases. We need to, you know, improve our risk calculators, certainly in kidney cancer. They're pretty old. You know, we need to, you know, come up with predictors of toxicity. There's early work from Sasha Gusev and Tony and others about, you know, who gets into trouble with these drugs. The only way to really get at that, because these side effects are rare, is to study large data sets. And the only way to pull those together is to pool data across tumor types, much in the way that it happens, the pooling of data happens, for example, much better in the stem cell transplant world, where they have databases that are collecting information on patients who are not always on trials. They're pooling what they learn. We're in a similar place. And you could argue we're in a more serious place because we're going to have more patients across the globe receiving these drugs. So I think you're right that we can't always extrapolate what we learn, but we can learn more than not by working together. And we have to insist on this same issues across tumor types, because ultimately, if we don't, if we just say PD-1 in the drinking water for every patient, we're going to harm patients, particularly in the adjuvant setting where many of them are cured already, and we're going to harm the field, I think, because people are going to start saying, well, these guys don't really, you know, they're not protecting our patients enough. You know, we can't afford to get two out over our skis on the true benefits of this approach, I think.
Brian, I've got a last and perhaps the most difficult question for you. You're a bit of a, dare I say, grandfather of, you know, of kidney cancer.
What?
You did the AXIS study. I remember your CABA. I remember the I remember watching
I'm just
the
subjecting
Bevis,
to the term grandfather. The go ahead.
The bevacizumab data back in you've watched this journey. You've watched this long journey. As you have, David, as well. But
David's older than me, I think. But anyway, go ahead.
And I got the impression that there was quite a lot of, you know, there was quite a lot of passion in the room at ASCO GU, and there was, you know, everyone wasn't agreeing necessarily. Mm-hmm. I thought that, you know, I think the data is compelling and a landmark moment to have OS. But I think there was some people who were pushing back a little bit. We've been happy in the past without crossover in our trial designs, and we haven't, you know, we've allowed in the past, you know, to watch the data mature and the number of patients getting subsequent immune therapy go up with time. What do you think is generating the anxiety around this particular setting by some of our friends?
I think it's that
the adjuvant and metastatic are very different, right? Because the the majority of patients won't recur, right? So even in our quote-unquote high-risk setting, most people are cured with surgery. And so it's different than in the metastatic setting where obviously people have disease. They presumably need systemic therapy. And if they don't get it, they're going to die from their disease, right? And so that's a tenet of the metastatic setting. And obviously there's caveats to that. In the adjuvant setting, there are plenty of people, maybe at least 50% or more, who could not get any more therapy, not be put in harm's way, and ride off into the sunset, right? And never have recurrence or death from kidney cancer. So those are totally different settings. So I think the anxiety, if you will, you know, in the room is just what David said, right? If you treat somebody who is never destined for recurrence and you harm that patient with permanent toxicity or, God forbid, life-threatening toxicity, like that's hard, right? That's a difficult thing, right? And as a physician where you're trying to help people, right, live better and longer, and you've done exactly the opposite, I think it's that fundamental difference that sort of drives the scrutiny of the data. And it should, right? I mean, we should be critical about the data. We should want more data. We should want more clarity because we're putting people in harm's way. I mean, I think that's our job as physicians, as drug developers, is to do that. So I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think it detracts from the data. You know, it's exactly what we should be doing.
It's the 300th podcast, Brian. Anything you want, David, anything you want to say before we call it?
I think that was very helpful. I guess I wonder when you guys are going to do the podcast on the Royal GU cancer speculation. Is that going to happen?
I don't think we should be doing, I'm not sure those podcasts are up our street. I mean, Brian, I know, is a really strong Republican. I know that's the case. He doesn't love George III. And he's made that really clear.
With George
III. He's made that very clear to me. And George Washington, as you know, was actually fighting for the British for most of his life. I mean, he started the Seven Years' War.
He finally came to his senses, I think.
He started the Seven Years' War on behalf of the British, which didn't help us very much, actually. So, no, we're going to be avoiding that podcast if we can. And, Brian, so 300, Brian, what do you think?
Yeah, hard to believe. Thanks to all the listeners. David, thanks for your contributions.
Yeah, glad to be here.
I've enjoyed it. I apologize to all the listeners for my poor introductions. I'm trying to improve them as we speak. Today was another example of a disaster. David, thanks very much.
All right.
It was really good today.
Thank you, David.
See
it was excellent.
All right, be well, guys.
Cheers, thanks. Bye.